welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 16th of August 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, another glorious week has begun in Blighty, and who better to begin the week's discussion with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. What's it like where you are in the country? It's a little bit overcast here. How are things where you are?
Yeah, the weather's a little bit overcast here as well, but it's warm. We've had the odd little bit of drizzle, but nothing to complain about. And as I said, I always set out with the intention of enjoying the weather, whatever it is, and that way the weather never spoils your day, and you can always have a good time. I think that as far as summer is concerned, one of the stories that's flying around at the moment is all about global warming, etc. But I don't see that there's anything for us to worry about here in Britain. Actually, it seems to be on the southern end of the continent, around the Mediterranean, where the really, really hot weather is occurring.
Yeah, we had some lovely warm weather this summer. I'm loath to think that the summer is yet over. I think we'll have some good weather again yet. And, you know, it really doesn't bother me if it gets a little bit warmer. They said that it was 1 degree warmer on average this year, but it was much warmer than that a few thousand years ago. We had some very, very warm periods. It was much warmer than it is now in the Middle Ages. We had grapes that were being grown for wine over here, the sort of temperature that you get in the Mediterranean we actually had in Britain. The earth does go through cycles. Whether we are affecting it or not with carbon dioxide, we might be, but even if we are, plants can take up to five times as much carbon dioxide than they actually get at the moment, and it just means that they grow more, so we just end up growing more fruit. But apart from the lovely weather that we had, we have had an absolute tragedy that happened last week. I mean, this was really, really terrible. A young white lad ended up killing his mother, himself, four strangers, including a three-year-old girl. Every one of them was white, and I think he ended up injuring three other people. And it's being portrayed in the media that this was an incel, an involuntary celibate, basically a young man that failed to really get on with the women. He didn't really get on with the girls at school, and he had problems with getting himself a girlfriend, had problems with fitting in, and blamed everybody else for his problems. This is how it seems to me. I looked at the video of him, and he seems to have a problem with personal grooming. I mean, if he wanted to impress women, why didn't he cut his hair? Why didn't he trim his beard? Why didn't he think about the way that he looked? Instead of trying to fit in so that he could attract a girl, he just seemed to blame all the girls for not being attracted to him with the way that he was, and that's a bad attitude to have. It's a sort of attitude that says that everybody else, I am looking to see what I can get from everybody else, instead of thinking, well, what is it that I have that I can offer to people? It seems to me he had the opposite attitude to life that he should have, and you know, that may be down to his autism, because apparently he was also autistic. The problem with this is that he had access to a shotgun. I mean, he just walked out and started using this shotgun, shooting at people. And the police knew that he had these autistic problems. His family had tried to contact them and said, look, this guy shouldn't have a gun. And they said, just look at his social media. And the police said, well, we can't look at his social media because that would go against his human rights. That's a privacy issues. But of course, the social media is public. It's not private. They weren't being asked to look through his private messages, just to look at what he'd actually put up there in public. And they failed to do that. And this guy went on a shooting rampage. I just, you know, it must be terrible for his sister, who is still alive, who now has to live with the fact that not only has her brother killed himself, but he also killed their mother, and he seems to blame the mother for all his problems. I mean, this incel culture, it also goes with the MG Tao culture, men going their own way, and there's a lot of problems with this. There is a problem with men getting girls, because men want to settle down for life, and women don't really seem to want to do that anymore. They've been encouraged to date as many men as possible, and to always go for the highest man. And of course, there are only a certain number of alpha males that are around, whereas men will sort of settle for whatever, basically. So you've got a problem now that women don't settle down for life, and men want to find a life partner, but to then blame everybody else because of the fact that he didn't actually get one, you know, that's the wrong way to be. Women are there to try and get men to improve themselves. I mean, the role of a man is a protector and a provider. And when you have your wife there, she's the one that says, well, I want the house to look like this. I want these appliances. I want this, that, and the other. And the man has to go out and work and earn the money for that. And then the man has to build these things. So the women inspire the man to take care of the home and to create things. And the man's role is more of a sort of spiritual role. And that's the way things should be. So really, he should have been looking at it, well, you know, these women, they've got high standards. So he needs to come up to those standards, not expect the women to drop down to his standards. I've got some quotes here about this. Shortly before the attacks, Davison called for a government-funded incel social program or rehab center to get them, meaning the incels, to do group activities to build confidence and self-esteem and get them out of their depressed mindset. And among his ideas were group therapy, activities such as rock climbing, and taking away computers, phones, and internet to detox from social media and the internet. And I looked at that and I just thought, this is such a shame this guy didn't actually come across nationalism, because this is exactly what Patriotic Alternative are doing. It's like a group therapy. It's a community that's being built around positive activities such as rock climbing, camping, going hiking, doing things to help the community. And he never actually came across nationalism. He actually wrote on his blog, when you have been a recluse for as long as I have, you search up and go on pretty much every subject on the internet. I can't think of a subject I haven't dabbled in on the internet. Technology, politics, space, exploration, astronomy, LGBT, transgender, movies, comics, video games, military, special forces, guns, weapons, tanks, jets, nuclear power, futurism, transhumanism, drugs, biology, and history. And it is so sad that he never came across nationalism, because most nationalism has been wiped from the internet. Because if he had have done, then we may have been able to reach this guy, and we may have been able to turn him around and get him to feel that he had a stake in society and helped him to improve himself so that he actually became a viable prospect for a life partner, for a girlfriend. It's so sad that this happened, and it's so sad that we are not able to reach out to people because we're just wiped from the internet. And the activities that we do, the positive community building activities that we do, we just get accused of, oh, you're just trying to groom youngsters into becoming extremists, which is, of course, complete nonsense. We're just trying to build communities, and we're trying to build community bonds. So I was so sad to see this. And I think this three-year-old girl has lost her life. And she was adopted as well. And the father that adopted her, he's lost his life. So the wife or the mother, she's left behind. I mean, the effects of this will be felt for years to come. You know, Plymouth must be absolutely reeling from this. Society is to blame in a certain way for the reasons that I've just outlined, but there's also personal responsibility here. And for some reason, he just blamed everybody else for his problems and didn't think that you know, he really needed to work on himself. It was everybody else that needed to fit in with him. That's my views on this. Max, what are yours?
Well, I think that there are two things, really. One is that there is an absolute obsession with sex in our culture at the moment, and this is largely generated by the mass media, where sex and thoughts about sex fill everybody's heads all the time. If you just look at the Red Top and the tabloid newspapers, they're just full of articles that are all about sex. They feature people that are obsessed with their sexuality, with their gender, with their gender identity. There's such a lot in our culture at the moment, which is orientated around the LGBT communities, and whenever they feature in television programs or anything of that sort, then there tends to be an obsession, not in every case obviously, but there tends to be an obsession with sex and their sexuality, making everybody aware of their sexuality. And I think that as far as this lad is concerned, the incels are a similar group, a group which is just obsessed with their own sexuality, and they seem to believe that they have a right to be attractive to the opposite sex. And if the opposite sex don't regard them as attractive, then they're being discriminated against, in the same way that LGBT communities believe they've got a right to be accepted by everybody. Everybody has to like them and feel comfortable with them. And if you don't like them and feel comfortable with them, then there's something wrong with you and you need to be punished. And this chap had got the same sort of attitude with regard to people in wider society. If girls didn't find him attractive, then instead of looking inwards at himself and, as you say, deciding, you know, what do I need to do to make myself more attractive to more girls, he blamed the girls, which is, you know, which is the kind of blame culture that exists as part of this, as I say, this obsession with sex and that type of thing. And the as far as the incels were concerned, because of the obsession with sex in society around them, they and as far as this chap was concerned, I think he was only 22 or 23, something like that, you know, he was behaving like an old spinster who thought that she was left on the shelf. You know, if you go back to Edwardian and Victorian times, it was, you know, generally regarded that if a young woman hadn't actually found herself a husband by the time she was 22 or 23, that she was left on the shelf and it was a cause for family shame, etc. And this lad, you know, hadn't got himself a girlfriend by the time he was 22 or 23, and he obviously felt very sort of uncomfortable with this. He felt that he was a failure, in the same way that that women used to feel they were a failure if they felt that they'd been left on the shelf. The thing that I think, though, that I'm glad you mentioned, is that despite the fact that there are social factors that undoubtedly had some effect upon Jake Davidson's mentality, the fact that he went out and killed innocent strangers, and particularly a three-year-old girl, I think, you know, that is absolutely heinous and unforgivable. He apparently, according to the account that I read, you know, he fired and shot the girl, and then when the father tried to shield her body with his own, he fired on the father and killed the father, and then stood over them and fired again into the little girl to kill her. And in my view, you know, anybody that can do that is beyond the pale. And I'm glad that he killed himself afterwards, really, because I don't think our society at the moment is strong enough. Certainly the government that we have at the moment isn't strong enough to actually deliver the death penalty, which is what he deserved. And he would have ended up becoming a burden to the state and spending the rest of his life in prison had he not killed himself. So I think it's good that he did kill himself in the end, but it's very sad that he had thought himself and allowed himself to become so depraved by the factors at play in our society that he felt that the only thing he could do was to commit those abominable acts.
Yeah, to do something like that. I mean, that's the reason why the women weren't interested in him in the first place, is because they could see that he was the sort of person that could do something like that. It's like, basically, he has said, well, all these women that weren't interested in me, they were correct, weren't they? Because this is the sort of person that I am, that is capable of doing something like this. And this involuntary celibacy, again, I'm glad you pointed out this concentration on sex in our society, and men feel that they aren't worth, you know, they don't have any value unless they have lots of girlfriends. I mean, that's not value. That wasn't seen as a man's value in the past. Plenty of men were celibate in the past, and they used their celibacy to concentrate all the energies that they had in going out and achieving things, and that's why we went out and we were pioneers, and we colonized America, and we built the British Empire, and a lot of that was done by celibates, and it was the power of celibacy that was harnessed into other creative avenues instead of being you, instead of your creative juices being used to create another human life, the creative juices were used to create structures and institutions and building new countries and building civilization and great artworks and great musicians. I'm sure we've talked about some famous celibates in the past. Tesla was a celibate. I think Isaac Newton was a celibate. Adolf Hitler was a celibate.
This is what used to be termed sublimated sex drive in times yes. gone by. People would have been a very energetic person who wasn't married. Was regarded as having a sublimated sex drive, and it was that drove him or her to achieve great things in other spheres.
If he'd looked at it in the positive way and looked, well, I am celibate, so what can I make of that? Well, that should mean that I will be able to concentrate on things more, and I will be able to create things, and I'll be able to put a lot more work into things. And he should have looked at it like that, look at the glass and see that the glass is half full rather than the glass is half empty. If the glass is half empty all the time, you're going to be depressed all the time. You're not going to achieve anything. If you look at the glass and you see that it's half full and it's not so bad, and what is the best that you can actually make out of this? That's the way you have to look at life. You have to think, well, I'm in this position. What does that mean that I can concentrate on now that I couldn't before? Because life is always trying to push people in a positive direction for them. But you just have to actually see what that direction is. And a lot of people, rather than looking for that, they'll just get angry about the position that they're in. And they'll say, well, why is it me? Everybody else doesn't have it as hard as I do. But there are always people that are worse off than you are. And it does help to think about that. I mean, this is just a tragedy all around. And if we did have more publicity for nationalism and for groups like Patriotic Alternative, that less things like this would occur. And it does seem as if the incel subculture is, it's a particularly negative subculture that blames everybody else for their problems. You know, that there are problems in society, but essentially you are responsible for your own life, and you have to take responsibility for it. He didn't want to take responsibility for the way that he was, and he just wanted to blame everybody else. And perhaps the incel subculture encourages that and encourages people to blame others, because it is much easier to blame others than to take responsibility for our actions.
Yeah. And nationalism is an ideology in which you devote yourself to the well-being of your nation. And had he found nationalism, then he would have known that the people that he killed were the people that he should have been defending. And the last thing that would have occurred to him would have been to have killed innocent people. And the last thing that he would have occurred to him would have been to kill an innocent three-year-old girl. And so, as you say, it is such a shame that young people nowadays are prevented from accessing the healthy ideology that we espouse.
Yeah, he needed some aims in his life, and if he'd understood about nationalism, then his aim would have been to do what he could for his people, and he would have discovered that he had all these resources and energy and drive in order to do that. You just have to look into this, and it awakens something within you that you want to do things for other people rather than for yourself, and all the people around you are also doing things for everybody else, and that's the way that it should be. Well, do you want to move on to that other subject that we wanted to get into, Max?
This is the subject of the black boy clock.
Yes.
Well, this is something which sort of follows on really from the Black Lives Matter campaign that there was last year, and the destruction of the statue in Bristol, whose name I can't remember, the chap whose statue was destroyed now, but
Edward Colston.
Edward Colston, that's right. Yes, and the. And what's happened now is in Stroud, which is over the same part of the country, there is a church which features on the side of the church a clock and a bell, and a little bit in the same way that a cuckoo clock exists. As far as this clock and bell are concerned, there is a statue of a of a young black boy on the side of the building who's holding a club, and he at the appropriate times of the day strikes the bell, and so therefore it rings out either presumably the time, and as I say, this clock has been there for 240 years, and it depicts a young black boy. So as far as a young black boy is concerned, a young black boy will have what are called pedomorphic characteristics, in the same way that young children have what are called pedomorphic characteristics. And these are that, generally speaking, their head tends to be slightly larger in relation to the size of their body than it would be in adulthood, that their arms and their legs are slightly shorter than they would be in adulthood, and that the child has got a slightly more pot belly than they might have in adulthood, in the same way that young children of 2, 3, 4, or 5 tend to have a little bit of a pot belly, and that's the way this child is presented. There is no caricature. There is no sense that the shape of this black boy is in any way deformed in order to ridicule his person. He's just presented as a young black boy. He's wearing what would presumably have been regarded as typical African clothing 240 years ago, in that he's got a beaded belt with leaves hanging down from it, but underneath the beaded belt and the leaves you can see what's intended to be a fabric skirt as well around his waist. And so it's not that the boy is shown as being naked in any kind of lewd sense or anything like that. He's wearing clothes which I imagine the majority of people in Britain in those times would have visualized when they thought of a little black boy, because quite likely when people who were going out to the far-flung parts of the world as sailors or explorers or whatever, when they went out there and they saw African tribes, they probably would have seen some people who would have been dressed in similar fashion. So therefore, there is no intention on the part to portray the black boy in any way grotesquely, or in order to ridicule the black boy or whatever. It's just a black boy with a club who hits the bell. And but apparently a local artist who's of mixed race, a chap called Dan Guthrie, has decided that the presence of this statue is insulting to black people, and a campaign has now been generated as a result of his statements. And and now there is a certain amount of argument between people who want to remove this black boy statue and people who think that it ought to be preserved. And the point is that how would anybody think that a typical African black boy should have been presented in a statue if the way this boy is being presented is regarded as being insulting? In what way is it insulting? You know, the statue is painted black in the same way that, you know, some tribes in Africa are, you know, so dark skinned that they do almost look black and would have appeared black in the minds of people living in Europe in those days. And and the boy's has the lips painted on as red lips. Well, now, that's hardly creating a statue that is in any way derogatory or in any way demeaning to black people. That's just a statue which is pretty closely modelled on what a black toddler would look like. And I can't see the reason for the objection, to be quite honest. And I think that it's a politically motivated objection. You could just as equally argue that the statue of John Colston in Bristol was a caricature of an adult white man, because he was wearing the clothes that people in those days regarded as typical of somebody, of a man of his standing in their society. And so showing something that's typical isn't a caricature. Showing something that's typical is showing something that's typical. A horse has got four legs, and if you produce a statue of a horse with four legs, it's typical of a horse. It's not a caricature of a horse, it's typical of a horse. And I think that the way that this statue has been created is typical of a young black boy. So I can't really see that there's any grounds for anybody to complain about it.
No, they're certainly making a big fuss about it. And the statue is just anatomically correct. I've got a quote here from the artist, this Dan Guthrie. He says, "My eyes lock onto the black boy clock every time I turn the corner onto Castle Street. The boy has huge red lips and is wearing a golden leaf skirt, and he is weirdly enslaved to the clock mechanism when it's working. It is an offensive racist relic from the transatlantic slave trade, and the fact it is still up in Stroud is a mystery to me." Well, do black people not have larger red lips than Caucasian people? I mean, they do. It's just anatomically correct. They're not a caricature of large red lips. I mean, they're not sort of huge red lips or anything like that. They're a different size to Caucasian, as you pointed out. Max, he was just wearing the clothing that you would have seen them wearing at the time. I mean, you would have seen them running around naked at the time. The fact that they put a golden leaf skirt on him, it is actually been rather modest. They certainly weren't trying to be offensive. And it says he's weirdly enslaved to the clock mechanism. Well, yeah, because he is a part of the clock mechanism. It's not that he's weirdly enslaved to it. He is a part of the clock mechanism. He strikes the clock in the same way as you would have a statue of, sometimes you get a statue of a little boy and he's weeing, and the fountain comes from the little boy when he's weeing, you know, as a water feature. And the actual statue is also the feature. And it's the same thing with this clock mechanism. He's actually a part of the clock. But it seems this debate has been going on in the town, and the town's Conservative MP has actually been pretty good. She has criticised local anti-racists campaigning to have the divisive figure relocated, and her name is Siobhan Bale. And she said, "A certain minority of people with loud voices have an unquenchable desire to be constantly finding things to be outraged at," in a statement published in the local press and on her website last month. So it's good to see that she's standing up for this. And then she suggested that Stroud Against Racism, which is the group that are whipping up all this hate, basically. She said Stroud Against Racism were whipping up a lot of online hate, and she thanked local people who have been accused of making racist comments for not being intimidated. She also demanded that council culture must be resisted and challenged whenever its tentacles attempt to grab our communities and to bully them into silence. So this is good. The local people have been saying, we don't want this, we're not having this, and they're refusing to back down, even though they've been accused of being racists. And this Stroud Against Racism group, they claim they've been subject to abuse online since Bailey's high-profile comments. Nabila Akhtar, who volunteers for the group, says she has received up to 20 racist and abusive messages on social media. She says this MP is creating a toxic atmosphere by peddling this false narrative that we want to silence people and erase history. She says that lots of the comments echo her language and then they get abusive. "I've been told people like you shouldn't have a say and you should go back to where you came from." I guess they could be deemed as a little bit racist. But then she actually quotes some of these so-called racist remarks. And this is coming from The Observer, so that they're obviously going to try and pick the worst remarks they can. And one of them says, "I'm getting tired of Black Lives This and Black Lives That." And apparently that's it. That's the worst of these racist comments that they can find. Well, people are getting a little bit tired of Black Lives Matter and seeing people kneeling down before every sports match and having it pretty much on the television all the time on the news. They're talking about Black Lives Matter. And people are saying, well, hang on a minute. Don't all lives matter? What about white lives? Why is it that we can't say white lives matter? Particularly on Indigenous Day, which it was this week. And there was a great campaign by Patriotic Alternatives to get people to say White Lives Matter on Indigenous People's Day. And of course, that got accused of being racist. And there was a second one here. There were suggestions that only those born and bred in Stroud should be expressing views on the black boy clock. Again, how is that racist? I mean, that is just common sense. If you live there, then you have a right to have a comment basically on your surroundings. They are your surroundings. But if you're not actually born there and you're not anything to do with it, then why should anybody pay any attention to what you have to say about it. So I think Stroud against racism are showing their true colours to the Stroud constituents, and I'm rather impressed with this MP for standing up for the people there and for standing up to the bullies at Stroud against racism, because that's what they are. They're just trying to bully people by calling them racist to get them to back down so that they can remove this statue or this mechanical clock, which has obviously been there for hundreds of years and which I'm sure lots of people remember from their childhoods and never once thought that it was encouraging them to hate black people in any way. It was far more likely to encourage them to be more accepting of black people and used to seeing them around if they're used to seeing statues of one there. What do you make of all of this and this MP that's standing up for this, Max?
Well, I'm really pleased with what she's been saying as well. It's a breath of fresh air to hear that kind of common sense. Another point I'd like to make is, well, you know, if there wasn't a statue of a black boy as part of this clock mechanism, somebody might turn around. The same people that are complaining about the clock would be complaining about the fact that perhaps in the entirety of Stroud, there isn't a single statue depicting a black person, and say that black people have been whitewashed out of Stroud's history, they would be complaining. And yet here they have a perfectly good statue of a young black boy, and they're complaining about that. And you're quite right that people are getting fed up with this constant focus ever since the death of what's his name, Floyd, and ever since the Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, that's it. Ever since the Black Lives Matter campaign grew up in America and spread over here, what we've had is a deluge of TV programs obsessing about black people and obsessing about issues that are either current issues or that are very often historic issues that nobody's actually excited about, but they obsess about them and try to get everybody excited about them. And I've noticed that there was it was announced over this weekend that a new docudrama is going to be screened by ITV about the life of Stephen Lawrence. And it's going to be like several episodes long. However, it happens, I'm not sure however many episodes they're going to be. If it's going to be called Stephen. And of course, what is effectively a docudrama will be presented as fact, and so therefore what we're going to find is that it's going to be damning of the police and white society in the way that the people who obsess over these things generally infer that white society is damned because of what white people are alleged to have done to black people in the past, and because of what white police officers are supposed to have done in the past. And I think it's quite understandable that people are getting a bit sick and tired of this now, because it's just everywhere. It's a breath of fresh air when there's a TV program that doesn't focus upon black civil rights. And if you go to go to BBC iPlayer and you just type in under the search bar black, the screen is just filled. There's like about six screens full of programs that focus about black civil rights issues, things that are perhaps no longer an issue. And so, for example, earlier on this year, there was a series, a three-part series. I can't think quite what it was called. It might have been called The Battle for Brixton, but it was all about the Brixton riots in the 1980s. And now there's another series that's come out, which is 13 episodes, called Uprising, which is about the new crossfire which led to the Brixton riots. These programs are just full of talking heads from the black community who are all espousing the notion, well, not all, but the majority of them espousing the notion that black people have got a right to feel hard done by and downtrodden because of this thing that happened in history, despite the fact that these Brixton riots happened 40 years ago. You know, it's not something that happened last week or last year or even recently. It's something that happened 40 years ago, and it's long forgotten, one would have thought. But if you just sort of look at a list of things that come up, if you type black into the search bar, as I say, on BBC iPlayer. There's Black Power, a British story of resistance, an examination of the Black Power movement of the 1960s. Well, who cares about the Black Power movement of the 1960s? Black is the New Black, a programme with Lenny Henry in it talking about his youth, Dreaming Whilst Black, a comedy supposedly about black people, Black and Welsh, Welsh Black Miners, Being Black at Cambridge, Pandora's Box, the 1957 Kwame Nkrumah dreamt of building an industrial utopia in black in West Africa, Our Black History Heroes, there's apparently a series of 10 of those for Black History Month, The Black American Fight for Freedom, Focus, Black Lives Matter, hits home 1 year from the death of George Floyd, Black Hollywood, They've Got to Have Us, a series of 3 documentaries there about black actors making it big in Hollywood. Do Black Lives Matter in Brazil? Well, who cares in Britain whether Black Lives Matter in Brazil? It's got nothing to do with Britain. One Extra, Andre Gray breaks down his black history tattoos and the icons that inspired them. The Next Step, elevating the black dancers who have appeared in Series 7. CBBC, Horrible Histories, Black British History. And then a programme called Imagine, where Alan Yentop meets Lenny Henry to look back at his early years in show business. The Mobo Awards, Famalam, already on Series 3. So, you know, there's just like no end to this tidal wave of programmes that are being produced now that focus on what it's like to be black and what and the issues that black people have had in the past, as if they are like fresh and the present situation that exists in Britain. When in reality, the situation that exists in Britain today is that there's lots of legislation that prevents black people from being discriminated against. And I really don't believe that black people are discriminated against any more than white people are discriminated against.
Well, I guess if you were to look up white in that search term as well, what you would come up with is white privilege, things to do with white slave owners, perhaps. You wouldn't come up with any positive terms that are linked with the word white.
No, and this is getting to the point now where all this deluge of this material oriented in this way can quite literally be described, in my view, as an incitement to racial hatred, in that all of these programs, well, most of these programs exist to denigrate white people and to make black people feel that mistreatment that any black person may have suffered in the past is currently still going on, and they ought to still feel aggrieved about it, and they also ought to still be campaigning about it, even though it's 40 years ago that it happened. Well, for heaven's sake, it's 40 years ago. Let's move on.
And another term that you will find is white supremacist. You'll find all these negative terms to do with white people, but you won't find anything positive to do with it, which is, of course, why we like to talk about positive news stories about whites here, and why we like to have our Greatest Britain series. Shall we get into Greatest Britain then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Carl Pearson. We began this series last week and we talked about how he came from a very intelligent Quaker family and went on to have very intelligent children, how he was the first to use statistics in a mathematical way in order to make predictions, particularly with regards to biology and race. A lot of his work is now called scientific racism, and this is an attempt to smear his discoveries by attacking the man himself. The results of his investigations are not discredited, merely the use that the scientists of the day found for them. Rather than saying one race was statistically better at one particular thing than another race, they simply claimed that one race was superior to another. He was a polymath and a genius, studying as many different subjects that he could find and applying the knowledge he accumulated across many different fields. He was offered posts at many prestigious universities, and he was seen as the heir to Sir Francis Galton, which we will talk about a little bit more today. Is there anything you want to add to that, Max?
No, that's a pretty good summary, I think, of Carl Pearson, yes.
Well, 1891 saw him also be appointed to the professorship of geometry at Gresham College, and here he met Walter Frank Raphael Weldon, a zoologist who had some interesting problems requiring quantitative solutions. This collaboration in biometry and evolutionary theory was a fruitful one and lasted until Weldon died in 1906. And Weldon introduced Pearson to Charles Darwin's cousin Francis Galton, who was interested in aspects of evolution such as heredity and eugenics. And Pearson became Galton's protege, and Galton became almost like a hero to him. After Galton's death in 1911, Pearson embarked on producing his definitive biography, that's of Galton, a three-volume tome of narrative, letters, genealogies, commentaries, and photographs published in 1914, 1924, and 1930, with much of Pearson's own money paying for their print runs. The biography being done to satisfy myself and without regards to traditional standards, to the needs of publishers, or to the tastes of the reading public, and that's a quote from him there, triumphed Galton's life, work, and personal heredity. He predicted that Galton, rather than Charles Darwin, would be remembered as the most prodigious grandson of Erasmus Darwin. When Galton actually died, he left the residue of his estate to the University of London for a chair in eugenics, and Pearson was the first holder of this chair, the Galton Chair of Eugenics, later called the Galton Chair of Genetics, in accordance with Galton's wishes. He then formed the Department of Applied Statistics, into which he incorporated the Biometric and Galton Laboratories, and he remained with the department until his retirement in 1933, and continued to work right up until his death at Cold Harbour, Surrey, on 27th of April, 1936. So he was very involved with Francis Galton, very interested in eugenics and heredity. And it's a shame that this chair got changed to genetics. It's just a great shame that eugenics fell from grace, really. And Galton really was a fantastic guy. I mean, I lean more towards him than Charles Darwin myself, but you know more about these people, Max. You've read some of their work, haven't you? Both Galton and Pearson. What do you know about his relationship with Galton?
Well, I think that he obviously did have a very close relationship with Galton, and it appeared that during that period of history that there were quite a large number of people who had similar ideas and who were polymaths, who enjoyed each other's company and who worked in a similar way, and who were, I suppose, the advocates of social Darwinism, the application of the theories of heredity and evolution to national life. And it's just such a great shame that. That firstly, the political situation in this country and probably around the world in general turned against them as a result of the Second World War, and so that the investigations into eugenics have been largely abandoned. Although to some extent there are some signs that scientists are now realizing that that lots of human characteristics are genetically determined, and it's only going to be a matter of time before sufficient numbers of them realize that the clusters of genetic information that exist roughly correspond with the races of mankind, and before they realize that race isn't a social construct, it is a natural thing. As far as these two characters were concerned, though, Galton and Pearson, they're two people who devoted their lives to investigation in these areas, and it is such a shame that even the institutes that they created in order to carry on their work have, as a result of their charitable status, had their focus diffused. And so instead of there being a chair for eugenics, it's now a chair for genetics. And what's happened in, and it's not just with regard to Galton and Pearson, this happened. It's happened to quite a number of scientists that were similarly minded to themselves, that the institutes that they founded and they left behind have, as a result of pressure applied to them by the Charities Commission, they have become more democratic and more and have, as a result of that, lost the determined and focused target of their investigation, and have been broadened into a study of genetics generally, and where the leadership of these institutes has been taken over by people whose views and whose aims in life are diametrically opposed in many cases to those of Galton and Pearson.
It's all about genetically modifying organisms now synthetically rather than through selective breeding, which was basically eugenics. And they do have some eugenics programs. We seem to have less people with Down syndrome now, and they screen people when they're pregnant. But at the same time, we have so many other dysgenic policies which reward people that don't really give that much to the nation, that aren't really of much benefit to the nation. It's the people that remain on benefits all their life, and they have lots and lots of children, or people that have multi-generational criminals in their family that have lots and lots of children, and they're rewarded with the benefit system, basically. And the idea of eugenics was that the people that were most likely to be able to contribute to everybody else would be given rewards for that. And the people that were not likely to produce people that were going to be of much benefit to everyone else were encouraged to not have children, basically. Just encouraged, not forced to, but just have policies that would encourage the best people to breed, and the least best people, I guess, if we can call them that, best and not best. I mean, there's probably a better way to describe it, but to encourage them not to breed. That's basically what you do with animal husbandry, and it's what you do with plants as well. It's what you do with pedigree breeds. It's just, you know, something that we've done for thousands of years. We just seem to think that it's wrong to do it with humans for some reason, which goes back to the Second World War. Well, there was another famous person that Pearson was involved with, and that's Albert Einstein. When the 23-year-old Albert Einstein started the Olympia Academy Study Group in 1902 with his two younger friends, Maurice Solovine and Conrad Habicht, his first reading suggestion was Pearson's The Grammar of Science. This book covered several themes that were later to become part of the theories of Einstein and other scientists, such as the relativity of motion to a frame of reference, fixed stars, the equivalence of matter and energy, physics as geometry, the non-existence of the ether, the importance of creative imagination rather than mere fact-gathering, antimatter, a fourth dimension, wrinkles in space, molecular relative position and motion, and the motion of corpuscles as relative motion in a field. So lots of scientific constants there that were actually originally thought up by Pearson and that Einstein popularized. Pearson asserted that the laws of nature are relative to the perceptive ability of the observer, and the irreversibility of natural processes is a purely relative conception. For instance, an observer who travels at the exact velocity of light would see an eternal now or an absence of motion. He speculated that an observer who traveled faster than light would see time reversal, similar to a cinema film being run backwards. And his relativity was based on idealism in the sense of ideas or pictures within the mind. There are many signs, he wrote, that a sound idealism is surely replacing, as a basis for natural philosophy, the crude materialism of the older physicists. And he stated that in the preface to the second edition of The Grammar of Science. And he further stated, science is in reality a classification and analysis of the contents of the mind. In truth, the field of science is much more about consciousness than it is an external world. Law, in the scientific sense, is thus essentially a product of the human mind and has no meaning apart from man. So he's getting into some really metaphysical concepts there, even though, I mean, he's talking about science, but he's crossing over into religious fields here. And this was when science was at its best, I think, around about this time, rather than now. What are your thoughts on all of this, Max?
Well, yeah, I think that when you study the nature of matter, when you study the extremities of the universe, etc., then science does butt up against, some people have traditionally said that science butts up against religion, and that there are some sort of aspects of religion that can be derived from science and vice versa. But certainly you end up with some very deep philosophical and metaphysical issues there about you know, the purpose of life, the part we play in it, and where we're going, how we got where we are, all these kind of questions. Many of these questions are questions that science can't actually answer, and so it therefore becomes a matter of how you visualize these things in your own mind as to what you believe. And so, for example, you know, people think about the origin of life, the origin of the universe, and they think about the Big Bang theory, and I think there is lots of evidence to support the Big Bang theory. But then the question that you then ask is, well, what came before the Big Bang? Because, you know, that's exactly the same question as people who believe in religion, where they talk about how God has existed for millions and millions of years and for throughout eternity. But you then come up with a question, yeah, but what existed before God? How did God come about? You know, God may have existed for a long period of time, but how did God come about? And it's the same with the Big Bang. Okay, if science tells us that the universe was created by the Big Bang, well, what came before the Big Bang? What caused the Big Bang? And it is the same question, one being a scientific question, the other one being a question of religion.
And you got the fact that he was the guy to think up relativity, and it was Einstein that popularized that. And when do you actually hear about Carl Pearson involved with it? You don't. You just hear about Albert Einstein. I mean, it's this was news to me that it was a British guy that came up with these ideas. Well, Pearson was a eugenicist who applied his social Darwinism to entire nations, seeing a war against inferior races as a logical implication of the theory of evolution. My view, and I think it may be called the scientific view of a nation, he wrote, is that of an organized whole, kept up to a high pitch of internal efficiency by ensuring that its numbers are substantially recruited from the better stocks and kept up to a high pitch of external efficiency by contest, chiefly by way of war with inferior races. He reasoned that if August Weismann's theory of germplasm is correct, the nation is wasting money when it tries to improve people who come from poor stock. And I'll just stop there before we get into this theory of germplasm. And people may look at what he said there about a war against inferior races as, this is terrible, this is racism. But when you think about war itself, it drives us on because we need to provide defences for ourselves. We need to defend ourselves against attackers from the outside. And it's that in itself that drives science, that drives progress. It is essentially down to defence. And you have to look at the outsiders as, you know, being a threat in some kind of way. And that is what has driven progress for all of these years. And I think that plays into this as well. And then you've got the competition. I mean, you've got competition between individuals and its survival of the fittest. And then you've got competition between the races and its survival of the fittest. And I think this is more of what he was talking about, rather than one race is superior and the race is inferior, because if you defeat the other race on that level at war, then they were inferior at making war, basically, weren't they? It's not that he's saying that one race is better than the other. He's saying that we have to have this competition to provide improvement. And obviously our complaint today about multiculturalism is that this is all going on within one nation. You have these competing groups within one country, as it were, rather than these groups competing as separate countries and separate nations and competing together to get the best out of one another. Instead of that, we have that actually going on within our country's borders. We have these groups competing against one another. So maybe the way that he put it back then may have been seen as racist, but he was basically just explaining the way that the world works, I think.
But quite often in popular sources like Wikipedia, etc., you'll find that quotations made by people like Carl Pearson will be taken out of context and deliberately done that way in order to make it easier to demonize the person. I think that the quotation that you read out is from a speech that Pearson made, which is called National Life from the Standpoint of Science. I think he made that speech around about 1914, something of that sort. And one of my favourite quotations from that speech, which I think pretty much fits with what you're talking about there, is it goes like this. "This dependence of progress on the survival of the fitter race gives mankind's existence its one most redeeming feature, that it is the fiery crucible out of which comes the finer metal." And so he is viewing the competition between nations as being a process of evolution that will prove which will create the an ever increasing improvement in the human condition, effectively.
You have to have competition to bring out the best in people. But as I was mentioning there, he reasoned that if August Weismann's theory of germplasm is correct, then the nation is wasting money when it tries to improve people who come from poor stock. And this theory of germplasm, that was actually proved correct, states that heritable information is transmitted only by germ cells in the gonads, which means the ovaries and the testes, not by somatic cells, which are the other cells of the body. And this idea is related to the idea that information cannot pass from somatic cells to the germline, which is contrary to Lamarckism, which is another theory, and this is called the Weismann barrier. And to some extent, this theory anticipated the development of modern genetics. In the germplasm theory, inheritance in a multicellular organism only takes place by means of the germ cells, the gametes, such as egg cells and sperm cells. Other cells of the body do not function as agents of heredity. The effect of this is one way. Germ cells produce somatic cells and more germ cells, but the germ cells are not affected by anything that the somatic cells learn or any ability that the body acquires during its life. Genetic information cannot pass from soma to germplasm and then on to the next generation. This is the Weismann barrier. This idea rules out the inheritance of acquired characteristics, meaning that training benefits only the trained generation. Their children would not exhibit the learned improvements, and in turn, they themselves will need to be improved. And there's a quote here: "No degenerate and feeble stock will ever be converted into healthy and sound stock by the accumulated effects of education, good laws, and sanitary surroundings. Such means may render the individual members of a stock passable, if not strong, members of society, but the same process will then have to be gone through again and again and again with their offspring, and this in ever widening circles. If the stock, owing to the conditions in which society has placed it, is able to increase its numbers." And that's just a basic scientific fact. If you have are people that only have a certain capacity to learn, and you teach them as much as you can and you bring them right to the limit of that capacity, the next generation is not going to increase its capacity. It is just going to stay at that capacity. You're not going to be able to fill more liquid into the glass. It can only contain a certain amount. And so what that means is as much as you teach people, as much as you educate people, as much as you give them these good laws, you're just going to have to do it all over again with the next generation. So if you have peoples that have a low average IQ, you're not going to be able to raise them up to having a high average IQ, because that is a heritable characteristic. As we pointed out here, he inherited his intelligence from his parents, and he passed that intelligence on to his children, that a very high intelligence, so that they were extremely successful. And that's why he was able to do all of this. If he had been low intelligence, they would have been able to, he would have been able to learn some things, but then the next generation, they would have, of his children, they would have had to teach them and work as hard as they could all over again. It's maybe I'm not explaining it that well here, but it's basically, go on, actually, maybe you can explain it better.
Yeah, there was a I think it was a French scientist called Lamarck who came up with the idea that a giraffe, for example, has got a long neck because the giraffe repeatedly stretches its neck in order to reach the leaves that are higher and higher on the tree. And so therefore, as a result of stretching, it then causes the animal's shape to actually change in doing that, and that this is where, for example, the somatic cells adapt to the environment in which the creature is living, and so it's the somatic cells that create the adaption, and that they, as a result of the adaption in the somatic cells, that is then passed on into the gene cells of the animal, i.e., its sperm or its egg, that will then be passed on to future generations. And so this is how, over a period of time, giraffes, for example, obtain their long neck. Now, that was then disproven in the vast majority of cases by the work of people like Galton, Darwin, and Pearson. And what they then established was that it is the genetic information that's passed on in the sperm and the egg that actually enables change to take place. And the change takes place as a result of individuals who've got certain capabilities either being adversely disadvantaged during their life as a result of those characteristics, and therefore having fewer opportunities to reproduce, and those individuals who have characteristics that enable them to be particularly successful in that same environment, having the ability to be more successful during their life, and therefore being able to produce more offspring that carry the same characteristics. So it's the selective pressure that sorts out whose germ cells are going to produce the next generation. So therefore, it is the chance mutations of genes within the germ cells that creates the differences, and that is the process of evolution that Darwin advocated. To some extent, that can still be questioned, though. As a general rule, what you said is absolutely correct with regard to heredity, etc. But in certain cases, for example, there is still research going on with regard to songbirds, for example, because you can take the egg that's been fertilized of a songbird, and you can put it in an incubator, and you can raise, keep it warm until eventually the egg hatches out, and until the bird that has hatched out reaches maturity. But that bird, even though it may be kept in a soundproof chamber and will have never heard the song that its parents sung, can still sing the song that its parents sung. And so there is, to some extent, something which is investigation goes on into, which is termed genetic memory, and there have been some more recent tests that have been done where generations of mice had been subjected to pain at the point where they eat. So they'll be offered food, and at the point where they eat, they'll have like perhaps electrodes attached to them, which will give them an electric shock, so that they then develop an aversion to starting to eat. What's then happened is that in future generations of these mice, it can still be measured that there is still a measurable extent of heightened anxiety when the animals go to eat, the offspring of the animals that were given the pain through electric shock. And so, again, this is possibly another example of inherited memory. But inherited memory doesn't exist to the extent that it will enable a weak and a feeble individual to produce, on average, a strong and powerful child, or an individual lacking in intelligence to produce a child that is of very high intelligence.
Well, I think we can also see with this germplasm theory, I think we can see with civilization as well. And this is why you have one race that builds civilizations and can always do that and has done that throughout history. And you have other races that have lived alongside the race that built the civilizations and they've been taught how to do it for themselves. But then when the race that does build the civilization is no longer there, the civilization falls apart because the other race that was there didn't have that ability in the first place. They'd been taught how to maintain it, but they didn't have the ability to create one in the first place. And that's why you see all these ruins of civilizations around us, is because the people that built the civilization are no longer there. They lost their ethnic ethnic integrity, the integrity of the nation. They ended up interbreeding with the other race that was there that didn't build the civilization, and they're no longer able to do it. Even though they've been taught how to do it, they end up forgetting how to do it because it doesn't come naturally to them, because what they learned during their lives of how to maintain it did not get passed on through their germplasm. But with the race that actually did create the civilization, they do pass it on through their germplasm. And that's why we have the birth of all these different civilizations throughout our history. And we'll get into Pearson's explanation of how civilization is produced next week, I think, Max, unless you've got anything else you'd like to add?
No, that's absolutely fine. I look forward to next week.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.